Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Strange Things in the Woods, a collection of terrifying stories by Steve Stockton, narrated by Joe Hempel. Introduction. All my life, I've been fascinated with the woods. While it's marvelous to be surrounded by nature, there is also, at times, a certain creep factor involved. As anyone who has spent a considerable amount of time in the great outdoors will tell you, there are some places in the woods that just don't feel right, for lack of a better word. Also, by the same turn, there are weird things to be found in the woods, many of which truly defy any rational explanation. As a youth, I grew up on a small farm in East Tennessee, not far from Knoxville and Oak Ridge. While not considered deep woods by any stretch of the imagination, we had several acres that were heavily wooded with old-growth timber. Factor in that our property also bordered vast, undeveloped land claimed by the Tennessee Valley Authority, TVA, and you have the perfect recipe for youthful adventure and exploration. Blessed with an active imagination and a love for adventure, these woods were full of countless hours of time spent looking for anything weird or out of the ordinary. As I grew older, my forays into the woods expanded, and I've had the opportunity to explore many national parks and forests. I sometimes saw strange things that defy explanation. My own personal experiences are currently being compiled for publication in a separate volume. Due to my own experiences in the great outdoors, I also began talking to family and friends, mostly older folks, and collecting stories of strange things they had encountered in the woods. This book is a culmination of those conversations. Many of the tellers of these tales have passed on, but their stories continue to live in my imagination and now in the printed word. Where possible, I've left the language and mountain slang intact, just as it was related to me, to give the true feel of the story. Whether you call a place a hollow or a holler makes no difference, as long as we understand each other. I hope you enjoy listening to these stories as much as I enjoyed collecting them over the years. If you yourself have ever encountered anything weird in the woods, I'd love to hear from you. Steve, September 2013. Chapter 1. The Flying Organ. I grew up on a several hundred acre farm in Jamestown, Tennessee, near what is now the Big South Fork National Park. My older brother Leonard and I were just kids, so this would have placed the event sometime in the early 1930s. We were down by one of the creeks on our property, about a half mile or so from our family's farmhouse. We lived in a very remote and rugged area of the Cumberland Plateau, and our nearest neighbor was several miles away. It was summertime, getting close to twilight, and we were cooling our feet in the creek. The day's chores were done, and it would be time for supper soon. Suddenly, off in the distance, we heard the strains of what sounded like an old-time church organ, the kind that required the organist to pump the pedals with their feet to produce sound. We immediately found this to be odd, because the nearest church was several miles away as the crow flies, and it would have been unusual for sound to travel such a great distance even in the quiet of the country. Much to our amazement, the sound continued to grow louder and seemed to be moving up the holler we were in, heading toward us. Eventually, the sound was close enough that we could indeed tell it was an organ and was playing a song, although neither of us recognized the tune. The sound became louder and louder and eventually seemed to pass right over the top of us, apparently coming from an invisible source just above the treetops. The musical notes continued playing as the still unseen object continued up the creek and then turned and went up across the ridge. The sound eventually faded into the distance until we could no longer hear it. There were no roads nearby, and the sky was clear and cloudless, yet we both distinctly heard the song as the organ approached, flew directly over us, again I'm guessing it was just above treetop level, and faded into the distance. There was nothing to see, it was only sound. Needless to say, we were spooked by the entire incident and beat a hasty path back to the house, arriving just before supper. Leonard and I never told our parents, and only talked about it occasionally between ourselves. It was quite some time before we were brave enough to venture back to the area of the creek where we had been, but we never heard the invisible flying organ again. To this day, I'm at a loss for a logical explanation as to what we heard. I guess we'll never know what it was, but it sure frightened two young farm boys. Chapter 2 The Crying Kittens. When I was a child, we had an old cat that hung around in the barn on our property. One spring, she had a litter of kittens up in the hayloft, 7 kittens in all. The old cat wasn't a very good mother and had abandoned the kittens, and unfortunately they were already dead by the time my brother and sister and I found them. We felt sorry for the kittens and decided to have a funeral for them down by the creek bank. We purloined one of Mother's old hat boxes from the attic, filled it with straw, and placed all the tiny, lifeless bodies inside. After arriving at the creek with our makeshift coffin, we said a few words, and my older brother dug a hole with a shovel in the soft ground. Sometime later, perhaps a week or more, my sister had gone to place some fresh-picked wildflowers on the tiny grave. Imagine her surprise when she heard the sound of kittens meowing. Thinking we had made a mistake and had buried the poor kittens alive, she ran back to the house and got my brother and me. My brother grabbed the shovel out of the barn, and we flew down to the creek bank as fast as our feet would carry us. When we arrived, we could hear the faint sound of kittens, too. My brother soon uncovered the box, and we quickly pulled it out of the ground and ripped the lid off the hat box. Much to our shock, we were greeted with the sight and smell of 7 very much deceased kittens. My sister took a stick and, holding her nose with one hand, gently prodded each tiny kitten. It was obvious they were all very dead. Mystified, we replaced the box into the grave and covered it back up. From then on, for many years, we all continued to hear the muffled sounds of tiny kittens near the grave. We could only assume that what we were hearing was the ghosts of these poor, tiny creatures. Chapter 3 The Giant Snake. This happened when I was a much younger man, I'd say 50 or more years ago. It was in the early spring, and I was out squirrel hunting in the woods with my .22 rifle. I hadn't gotten many squirrels that day and observed that there wasn't hardly anything stirring in the woods, not even birds. I thought that maybe something had all the woodland creatures spooked, maybe a bobcat, as they were common in that part of the country at the time. I shouldered my rifle and decided to make my way back to the house, figuring I'd just have to be content with the 2 or 3 squirrels I had bagged earlier. At one point, I arrived at the creek and started following it back toward the house, figuring I still had a mile or more to go until I reached a place where it was shallow enough to ford. I came upon a small clearing when I spied what I thought was a log lying across the creek. Surprised at this good fortune, I knew if I could cross the creek here, it would save me a lot of walking. I was just about to step on the log to see if it would hold my weight when the log moved. What I thought was a log turned out to be the biggest snake I've ever seen. Stunned, I watched as the snake's tail came into view as it slithered across the creek. Now, this was in East Tennessee. We don't have snakes as big as telephone poles. I wish I could have gotten a look at the snake's head, but by the time I came to my senses, I realized I'd better get out of there. No wonder the creatures of the forest were spooked. As big as the snake looked, I was afraid it would try to eat me. I made it back home and was met with disbelief when I told my tale of the giant snake. But I know what I saw. Years later, I saw a giant snake at a traveling carnival that was almost as big as the one I saw. It was, I believe, some sort of articulated python from South America. The only thing I can figure out to explain my sighting was that the snake I saw was an escapee from another carnival. I never saw the giant snake again, but I was always extremely careful out in the woods after that. Chapter 4 Disintegrating People. This is the story of the weirdest thing I've ever encountered in the woods. It was the summer after my freshman year of high school, and my friends and I often went to Blank Park on Blank Lake, exact location redacted at the original author's request, when the weather was nice. The lakeside park backs up to another state park that has lots of hilly terrain covered with hiking trails. It had become kind of cloudy on this particular day, so my friend Jenny and I thought we might explore in the woods and maybe try some of the hiking trails. As we ventured into the woods, we veered off the trail and came across what I can only describe as a primitive campsite. There was a lean-to made from pine boughs, a stone fire pit, and evidence that someone had been there recently, namely empty Coke cans and snack food wrappers. Ginny and I poked around the campsite for a bit and, growing bored, decided to venture farther toward the lake. About 100 yards from the campsite, we happened upon one of the scariest things I have ever seen in my life. There, on the ground in the woods, were 2 complete sets of human clothing, one male and one female, laid out as if the people were still in them. The man's outfit consisted of a lightweight tan windbreaker, a button-up shirt with a yellow checked pattern, a white t-shirt, khaki pants, socks, and brown leather shoes. The t-shirt was inside the checked shirt, which was tucked into the pants. There was even a belt in the pants. The socks were still in the bottom of the pant legs and went down into the shoes. The woman's ensemble was just as creepy. A pale blue windbreaker over a printed dress, with tan-colored hose ending inside a pair of penny loafers. Furthermore, the right arm of the man's clothing overlapped the left arm of the woman's clothing, giving the appearance that the couple had lain down on the forest floor and had been holding hands. Now, there were no bones or anything like that, and the clothing still appeared to be in a fairly new state, and hadn't been in the woods very long. We prodded the clothes with a stick and heard what sounded like loose change or maybe car keys jingle in the pocket of the man's khakis. Suddenly overcome by fear, Jenny began crying and said we needed to leave right now. I agreed. I was feeling totally scared and freaked out. It looked as if the couple had lain down and simply disappeared, leaving their clothing behind. By now, both of us were in tears, and we ran the rest of the way out of the woods. We debated over several days as to what we should do. Maybe call the cops? Or take some other friends back and show them what we had found? We scoured the local papers for weeks, but never turned up any information about a missing couple. In the end, we decided the best thing to do was to keep it to ourselves and never go back into the woods. And we never have and probably never will, although it has now been close to 15 years since the incident occurred. Chapter 5. The Spirit Tree. I had gone on a trip to the Sequoia Museum in Vonore, Tennessee, to do some research for a film script I'd been hired to write. After I finished my research in the museum, I had decided to stroll around the grounds for a bit and see what there was to see outside. At one edge of the paved parking lot, there is an Indian mound where the remains of many Native Americans are interred. It's commemorated with a plaque, and there were many Native American objects left on the mound as tribute, items made from such things as bird feathers and deer sinew. I stood near the mound and contemplated these indigenous peoples and their fate. Afterward, I decided to venture back into the woods behind the mound, seemingly drawn to a particular area for some unknown reason. After a short walk, I found myself in a clearing with the strangest tree I have ever encountered. It was very large and very old, several feet around at the trunk. I'm unsure just what type of tree it was, but I think it may have been a beech tree. The tree was so massive and so otherworldly looking, it seemed totally out of place among the pine, oak, and elm. The area beneath the tree was devoid of any plant life, covered instead by a thin layer of leaves over dark, fertile ground so barren otherwise that it gave the appearance of having been swept clean. I knew right away that this was someone's power spot, as I could feel the energy. This tree was so huge, and so old, and so magnificent that it seemed more like a Disney creation than an actual tree. I stood at the base and meditated for a few moments, feeling the waves of energy, when I abruptly felt a darker, heavier presence, as if I was being watched. I suddenly was overcome with a mixture of fear and sadness. I felt like I was an intruder, and this was a sacred place, even though I am 1/8 Native American by birth on my father's side. I took a few pictures of the tree, and then hurriedly left the area. Once I got home and I looked at the digital pictures on my computer, I wasn't surprised to see what some call orbs or spirit lights in the photos. I've visited the tree on a couple more occasions since, but always end up feeling like I'm somewhere I don't belong and beat a hasty retreat after a few minutes. The tree, which has stood for hundreds of years, and I suspect will be there for hundreds more years to come, still stands and can be visited by anyone. But if you do visit, please be reverent and respectful. There are protective spirits in these woods, and especially around this particular tree. If you visit it, you will immediately know what I'm speaking about to be true. Chapter 6. Native American Spirits. It was Thanksgiving weekend, and my parents and I had traveled to the family farm to spend the holiday with my grandparents and some of my aunts and uncles and their children. The farm was expansive and covered over 900 acres. In addition to many creeks and a river, there were also many natural features such as caves and bluffs, where centuries ago the Native Americans had hunted and lived. My mom and dad and I were the first to arrive, and I decided to go out exploring while waiting for my older cousins, Jerry and James, to show up. I considered walking down to cross the creek and mess around in one of the many livestock barns, but it had begun to spit snow, so I decided to go in the other direction down past the corn crib instead and visit one of the Indian bluffs that dotted the property. I made my way through the woods and down the steep bank above the bluff, carefully taking my time as the snow was starting to stick a bit, which made for tricky going. I finally arrived and went under the bluff and decided to build a small fire in the ancient fire pit to keep myself warm. I ventured a little ways out into the woods, gathering dry twigs and pine cones with which to build my little fire. On my way back into the cavern-like area under the bluff, I thought I heard voices in the distance. I assumed Jerry and James had arrived and would soon be joining me. I continued building my fire as planned, and soon had a nice little blaze going in the fire pit where the Native American inhabitants of centuries ago had cooked their meals. Every so often, I could still hear the sound of muffled voices in the distance. Thinking nothing of it, I continued tending my small fire and looking around in a loose soil underneath the bluff, hoping to find a lost arrowhead or two. At the time, it wasn't uncommon to find these much-prized pieces of worked flint. I kicked at something in the dirt, thinking it might be an arrowhead, but it turned out to be a bone. Just as I pulled the bone from the dirt, the voices became louder. I walked to the opening of the bluff, expecting to see my cousins and share my find with them. Looking this way and that, I could still hear the voices, but no one was in sight. At this point, the sound seemed to be coming from the top of the bluff. I decided to walk back up and see if my cousins were on the top, perhaps trying to find the way I had used to climb down. When I reached the top of the bluff, however, there was still no sign of my cousins. I could still hear the muffled voices, but now they seemed to be coming from the bottom of the bluff instead of the top. At first I was a little perplexed, but thought maybe Jerry and James had gone down the other side, and we had missed each other in the process. So I began the task of making my way back down, taking my time, as there was a good dusting of snow on the path now, which made for slippery going. One wrong move, and I could slide all the way down the steep hill past the bluff, ending up getting soaked in the creek and maybe even injuring myself in the bargain. Picking my way along carefully, I made it back to the entrance to the cave and found myself still alone. What was going on? I immediately thought of the bone that I had found, which I had stuck into my jacket pocket. It suddenly occurred to me that this might be human remains. It wasn't impossible, but to my knowledge, only one skeleton had been found in the cave years ago. The skeleton had been buried sitting up, suggesting the body had been that of a Native American chief. Under the bluff, I could still hear the muffled conversation, and as I strained to listen, it began to sound more and more like English was not the language being spoken. This sent shivers up my spine. Hurriedly, I replaced the bone in the soft earth where I had found it and covered it well. In my mind, I apologized to whomever or whatever I had disturbed. I had the growing feeling that I needed to leave this place as soon as possible, which I did as soon as I'd put out my little fire. When I got back to my grandparents' house, my cousins had just arrived and were still helping their parents carry food out of the car and into the house. I spent the rest of the evening pondering the events of the day, and the next morning, when my cousins wanted to go exploring, I refused to go anywhere near the bluff. I never told them the reason, but they didn't seem to mind, as there were lots of other places to explore. I was a grown man before I ever ventured back under the bluff again, although during those later occasions I did not hear any more voices, and I also took care not to disturb any areas that I thought may be sacred to my ancestors. Chapter 7. The Abandoned House. This happened in the mountains of North Carolina. My husband at the time was in the military and we were stationed at Camp Lejeune. One weekend, we and another military couple decided to go camping in the rugged Appalachian Mountains on the other side of the state. After setting up camp, we decided to hike around for a bit in the hilly, mountainous terrain. Deep in the woods in a little hollow, imagine our surprise when we chanced upon an abandoned Victorian house. It was almost overgrown with kudzu vines, but we still managed to find a way inside and decided to explore. Once in, we were amazed at the surprisingly good condition of the inside of the house. Upon further inspection, we found the house to be fully furnished and also found clothing and even old children's toys. It was more than a little creepy, and we all got the feeling we shouldn't be there. It was as if the people who lived there had just stepped out and would return at any moment. Our husbands were just as mystified as we girls were, although they didn't seem as scared. My husband, Richard, even began checking the walls for any hidden passages, thinking perhaps the family had gone into hiding for some reason and then perished, trapped inside the walls. I can't express how much the house still looked lived in. There was clothing laid out on the still-made beds, and plates and silverware set out on the dinner table. Everything was covered with a somewhat heavy layer of dust, however, so it was obvious the place hadn't been lived in for decades. This was the early 1960s, although the musty calendar on the kitchen wall was from 1909. Was it even possible that no one had entered this dwelling in over 50 years? The longer we spent in the house, the more scared my female friend and I became, eventually becoming almost hysterical. Eventually, after much pleading, our husbands decided we should leave, although they would have been happier to stay and explore the house more. After we had left and the shivers wore off, all we could discuss on the drive back home was how isolated the house was. It was literally in the middle of the woods, and the nearest paved highway was miles away. A few weeks later, our husbands planned a trip back, alone, to continue exploring. My friend and I were fine with that. Although I was curious about the house, I had no desire to visit again after the sense of fright that had enveloped me there. However, when the guys came back home the Sunday evening after their planned trip, the story became even stranger. Although they were sure of the exact location, they had been unable to find the house and had spent the entire weekend wandering the woods. Even though they remembered and recognized natural landmarks, no trace of the house could be found. They even stopped at a roadside general store a dozen or so miles from where the house had been, and when they inquired about the house, the proprietor emphatically denied that any such house existed. When my husband and his friend persisted, the man at the general store suddenly became angry and told them to leave, adding that if they knew what was good for them, they should forget the house and never come back. They ignored the warning and went back on two other occasions, but could never again find the house. And, like the owner of the general store, any of the locals whom they chanced upon and asked about the place refused to talk about or even acknowledge it. I know what we saw, and I know that it was real, but not being able to find it again and the local folks not wanting to talk about it only adds to the mystery. Did we chance upon the site of some unspeakable tragedy? I may never know the answer, but I will always wonder about the abandoned house deep in the woods. Chapter 8. Footprints in the Snow. The weirdest thing that I ever saw in the woods happened when I was just a boy, maybe 10 or 11 years old. It had snowed heavily the night before, so I was enjoying a day off from school. It had been canceled due to the weather, by walking around in the early morning snow-covered silence. I was quite a ways back in the woods, maybe a mile or so, when I happened upon some footprints. They were human footprints, but smaller than my feet, so I assumed they belonged to a child of maybe 5 or 6 years old. And to top it off, whoever had left the prints in the snow had been barefoot. It was about 34 degrees and much too cold for anyone, let alone a child, to be out wandering barefoot, in the snow, no less. I noticed right away that there were no footprints, bare or otherwise, leading up to where the tiny footprints began. I followed the prints for a few hundred yards, where they abruptly ended in a small clearing. I looked all around, even up in the trees, but could find no trace of the small child who had made the prints. I followed them back again to where they began, still just as mystified as ever. Still puzzled, I made my way over to my friend's house and told him about what I had seen. He got dressed for the weather, and we both trekked back out into the woods. When we arrived, the footprints were still visible, but just barely. The freshly falling snow was filling them in. We scoured the entire area for maybe a square mile, but never found more footprints or any evidence of the child who had made the ones we both observed. To this day, I still can find no rational explanation. That's my story of the weirdest thing I ever encountered in the woods, and I'm glad I have a witness who will back it up. Chapter 9. Evil in the Woods. The weirdest, creepiest stuff I ever found in the woods happened when I was a teenager. I'd only been driving a few years and had an old 71 Chevrolet Impala. It was a road boat and a gas guzzler for sure, but I loved to get out at night and drive around by the moonlight. There was an abandoned subdivision tract I had found during my ramblings, and I decided to go back one night and check it out. There were no houses, only what seemed like miles of paved road that went far back into the hills. The original developer had gone bankrupt, which was why it was left in the state it was in, all the building lots long since overgrown with brush and sapling pines. On this particular night, I had found the furthest extreme of the paved road blocked by a fallen tree. Feeling somewhat adventurous, I got out of my car with a flashlight to see if the tree could be moved. However, it was a beast of an old rotten oak and must have weighed close to a ton. There was no way I could move it by myself. Deciding that I wasn't finished exploring for the night, I decided to lock my car and go ahead on foot. I figured since the road was blocked, I was safe, as there would be no one else in the area. After about half a mile, the pavement stopped and continued on as a gravel road leading up a steep hill. I sallied forth, undaunted, happily stomping along in the gravel while enjoying the noise it made as it crunched beneath my boots. At the top of the hill, the gravel road ended as well, and now the road became nothing more than a rutted path through the high weeds and briars, with huge trees flanking either side. I was still feeling adventurous and decided to press on, determined to see how far I could go and where I would eventually end up. About a half a mile along the footpath, it curved sharply to the right. At the corner where it curved, I was playing my flashlight over the woods when the beam suddenly struck something out of the ordinary. On the slope of a short, steep bank, someone had fashioned a crude arrow shape out of some logs and branches of varying size. It looked too perfect to be random, so I was sure it was some kind of trail marker. I debated for a couple of minutes, then decided to abandon the path and see where the primitive trail marker led. At the crest of the bank where the arrow pointed, I found another narrow but well-worn path, which led deeper into the woods. I forged ahead, enjoying the adventure and solace that comes with being out in nature. The path twisted and turned a bit, but was leading uphill to the top of a ridge. When I arrived at the top after a good half hour of hiking, I thought I would perhaps be met with a vista overlooking the city or the nearby lake. Instead, what I found made my blood run cold. Where the ground leveled out in a fairly large clearing was a gigantic pentagram made from carefully arranged logs. I mean, this thing was huge. There were other logs set up outside the circle of the pentagram, which reminded me of altars. There were also upside-down crosses planted at various spots. By now, I was actually sweating and shaking, jumping at every sound I heard and playing my flashlight all over the trees, trying to catch sight of anyone who might be hiding. I caught a glimpse of something in the middle of the large pentagram and shined my light on it for a better look, it turned out to be the remains of some large bird, perhaps even a duck.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?